Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday the 20th of January 2021 and you're listening to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. I'm David Taylor and with me as usual to discuss the latest toings and froings in the UK construction industry is Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service which you can find at www.theconstructionindex.co.uk. It's a grey old morning this morning, isn't it, Phil? Have you got anything to brighten things up?
It's grey here too. I hope that we can throw a little bit of sunshine into people's week with some good news for small businesses to kick us off.
Right, well, that's good.
Yeah, but the news which we ran on Monday this week, starting off the week, was that Tuesday, that the government's prompt payment code, the rules under which big companies or companies have to pay their suppliers, are being tightened. If you employ fewer than 50 people, you can expect to get your bills paid in 30 days instead of within 60 days. Now, within 30 days is normal. You should be getting your bills paid within 30 yeah. days. But the prompt payment code, people who sign up to that and the 3,000 companies or so, which is a lot, but not that many, if you think how many companies there are in the country. Mm. 3,000 companies signed up to it. They are committed to paying 95% of their invoices within 60 days. Well, now they'll have to pay them within 30 days or risk a rap on the knuckles or worse from the Small Business Commissioner.
Of course, everybody puts terms 30 days, don't they, at the bottom of their invoices and sort of send them off hoping that it might actually prompt somebody to pay them on time, and it seldom happens. But I mean, it is a voluntary code, isn't it? As you said, there are, I think, 3,000 companies that signed up to it, and of course that's far from everybody. So, you know, these are companies which have already said that we're prepared to do this. Do you ever wonder why somebody would want to sign up to a code that restricts them to that extent? Don't you think that they might want to extend payments a little bit when times are a little bit tight?
I think if all your competitors, if you take our construction industry, if all your competitors, if all 9 of the top 10 construction contractors have signed it and one hasn't, it is kind of wearing a big hat on your head that says, I'm a complete bastard.
Yeah, that is true. So it's peer pressure. That's what makes it all work. And does it work? I mean,
yeah, no, it does. I think
companies sort of drop in and out of this code, don't they? They get suspended from time to time because they've been shown to be completely flouting the spirit of the entire thing.
Yes, numerous of the big contractors that we're familiar with have been thrown off or suspended for a period of time, and they've gone away and reassessed their processes and reorganised and been allowed back on because they've reduced or improved their payment records. And it is something that a lot of big companies in annual reports will report, in the same way that for some years they've been talking about their accident and injury rate and days lost to injuries and so on. They are now talking, reporting in their annual reports how long it takes them to pay their suppliers. And it's become a metric, a KPI, a key performance indicator for good business, responsible business, which in this whole thing of social value and everything is all part of the equation of businesses doing good, not doing bad.
Yeah, so they'll all be delighted that they now have to pay their small business suppliers within 30 days instead of 60 days. Of course, their larger suppliers, they can still pay within 60 days, can't they? It's not sort of across the board.
Correct.
So, yeah, that is good news. Yeah, if it works.
I'm slightly tinged with cynicism, I should say, no more than that, by this measure, because I'm familiar with companies who receive an invoice and don't necessarily go, got your invoice, thanks, we'll process it, you'll turn it around in the next end of the month, whatever. They tend to go, well, they tend to say nothing, and then you chase it up a few weeks later and saying, got the invoice, said no.
Yeah.
So well, I sent it. I said, oh, no, that's the wrong email address. Or, oh, no, you have to send it in the post. Oh, no. So they tend to drag their heels and then send the invoice back because you've not read the small print on how you're supposed to submit invoices to them. And the actual bureaucracy of submitting an invoice can be cleverly and deliberately extended to delay payment.
Well, I'm sure that a lot of small suppliers, small businesses out there will be familiar with the situation where they send in their invoice with the statutory payment terms 30 days at the bottom of it. And when they don't get paid within 30 days and query this, the client turns around and says, yes, but our payment terms are 100 days or something like that. So it's, you know, we my payment terms are bigger than yours.
Yeah.
So you know, you have to just swallow it. And of course, I suppose the thing about getting a little bit uppity about being paid on time, and when I say uppity, I'm not saying that to disparage people who insist on being paid on time. I think they're perfectly entitled and should demand that. But the thing is that if you are perceived as being a little bit uppity or a little bit too quick to phone up on the 31st day to say, where's my payment? People will say, well, I'm not using them anymore. They're a bit whingy. They're a bit needy.
That is the danger.
You've got to play it very carefully, I think. The fact that the code has been tightened up, I suppose, is a step in the right direction. And many businesses will be pleased about that. And of course, it's been couched in terms of helping the economy to recover from COVID, hasn't it? And the business minister, not a name I'm familiar with, I can't remember what it is actually.
Paul Scully.
Paul Scully, yes. Yeah, said, our incredible small businesses will be vital to our recovery from the coronavirus pandemic, supporting millions of livelihoods across the UK. So, you know, what's not to like? You pay them on time because they're keeping the economy ticking over.
Absolutely. I think I mentioned before that my accountant always sends me her invoices come with very short, I think something like 2 weeks or something. It says if you pay in a week or in 10 days, you get a 10%, you know, knock 10% off. Immediately, I always pay those invoices within 10 days just to save the 10%.
Well, yes, that's quite an incentive actually, isn't it?
Now, I suppose that a lot of people in the construction industry are working on such slender margins, they can't afford to give away 10% to get paid quickly. But if you are able to pad your upfront price a little bit in order to do then offer a discount for prompt payment, it seems much more conducive to getting results than what you're saying earlier. You know, you're late, I'm going to set the lawyers on you, or you're late, I'm going to now charge you the statutory 10% over late payment charge or whatever. No one wants to do that. This whole subject of prompt payment, late payment, it's been a running sore for the construction industry for years and years and years. And of course, it wasn't helped many years ago when, I don't know whether Michael Heseltine was president of Board of Trade at the time, but he was something important in government. And he was one of the few government ministers with proper business experience. He ran a successful publishing company, Haymarket Press.
Yeah.
And he basically admitted that it was a badge of honour if you're running a business and trying to juggle bills. Part of good management, good housekeeping, is not paying bills on time, waiting as long as you possibly can before you pay your bills, keeping the wool from the door, and that's what it's all about.
Oh, how things have changed. You couldn't get away with saying that now.
Couldn't get away with saying it, but a lot of people still get away with doing it.
Yes, that's true. Maybe you're just being honest. This business about hanging on to your money and paying people only when you really, really have to is a mindset which is, you know, endemic in the construction industry, always has been. And this is why people are very, very hot under the collar about the proposed, well, the new reverse charge, VAT reverse charge regulations, which are coming into force very shortly, I believe. Instead of the supplier paying the client the VAT and then passing it on further up the line until it reaches the Treasury, you pay the VAT now direct to the government. So clients aren't particularly happy about that because they have been relying quite heavily on having this flow of money coming in from VAT money, which isn't theirs. You know, it's VAT money, belongs to the government. And they're not getting it now, so their cash flow is suffering. And I can't remember which government minister it was who pointed out that this is irresponsible. You shouldn't have to rely on cash flow which isn't your money. So if you run a proper business, you should be able to run it perfectly well without relying on that VAT money going through your accounts department.
And I'm going to guess that that government minister who said that was either, before they went into parliament, a school teacher, a journalist, or more likely some sort of apparatchik who had no proper business experience.
Or an accountant, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, maybe an accountant. Yes, because people do. People inevitably rely on that sort of money. It isn't the government's money until the government actually gets it, until it's filtered its way through the supply chain. But not anymore. It's going to change. So yes, it's the same sort of situation here. I think that people like to hang on to the money and not pay their suppliers until they absolutely have to.
Well, on the subject of government regulations, and it's kind of ironic when the whole thrust of Conservative governments is in the direction of removing regulation and freeing up businesses from red tape, we have a new regulatory authority being set up. News comes out this week of the National Construction Products Regulator, which is all part of the response to the inquiry into the, or the investigation into the Grenfell Tower fire. Judith Hackett was commissioned by government to look at what that fire, what the use of the wrong cladding, bad cladding, to use shorthand, tells us about the shortcomings of our building regulations.
Is it the building regulations which are under criticism here, though? I think isn't it self-certification which is the problem?
They're all tied in. Yes, specifically, I think. I mean, for the building regulation, we've got sort of building regs are being reviewed by another arm of all of this. But this particular new product, building products regulator, the fact that it's being set up demonstrates that government recognises construction industry's self-regulation has failed. The construction industry has proved itself, and by construction industry, I mean the entire supply chain and all the consultants and agreement bodies and certification bodies and so on, have proved themselves incapable, untrustworthy, inadequate, can't be left alone, and the government has to step in. And that's what's happened this week. And I don't think there'll be many people who will say, this is not necessary, this is a bad thing. I don't think the free marketeers have got a leg to stand on anymore.
But there's an awful lot of them. I mean, you mentioned the British Board of Agrement. You've got all the other sort of independent third-party testing and certification bodies like Warrington Fire and the Fire Protection Association and BRE. I don't know if the BRE would come under that banner as well, but all these privately owned independent testing houses, their reputations are being trashed, aren't they?
Well, they make their money telling people, you're great, have a Blue Peter badge. That's what they do for a living. And the more Blue Peter badges they can sell, the better their business is.
Yeah.
And so clearly there's an inherent flaw in that approach to product regulation.
So does that mean that these independent privately owned bodies are essentially redundant now? Are we going to see them sort of fall by the wayside, and we're now going to have everything centralised and certificated and tested by government bodies?
I don't think the government has the capacity or even the appetite to do that. I think what we've got is probably the government certifying certification bodies, perhaps. Which I think already happens. I mean, you or I can't set up as badge giving outfits. I don't think we'd have much credibility. I think you have to establish your credibility.
No, I think that's a given. But for as long as I can remember, the British Board of Agrement has been resented by a lot of people in the industry and criticised by a lot of others for being, as you say, an issuer of its own certificates. And I don't want to cast aspersions, especially as I'm not really qualified to speak about this. But you know, if you can design your own testing procedure and set your own standards criteria as a manufacturer of a product, and then get a third party to test against those criteria, it's pretty weak, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't actually carry an awful lot of authority because you're testing, you're designing a test for the product rather than designing a product for the test. And I think that, you know, we'll probably find out that that's the sort of thing that was happening in the lead up to the Grenfell Tower fire.
But this all ties in with the car emission, exhaust emission scandal of, was it 5 years ago now?
Oh, yeah, Volkswagen.
When the car manufacturer was saying, our cars are perfect, they're clean, and someone else tested them and said, no, they're not, they're rubbish, they're filthy. And, that you know, an awful lot of angry consumers claiming their money back for buying dirty cars.
So how will this new product... You know, product regulator, how will it work? And I mean, is there going to be one person who will be wearing a badge saying I am product regulator, or will it be a big body? So I know it's part of it's a sort of subdivision of a division of the of a government department, isn't it, which was set up in 2018 or something.
I didn't know that new. It's going to be part of what's called the Office for Product Safety and Standards.
Which that's
is
right, yes.
A bit of the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy.
That's it.
So I don't know how many people, how big. I suppose it doesn't know. It's probably got to start out by working out its own terms of reference and how much work is needed.
It's got a £10 million budget, hasn't it?
Initial budget of £10 million.
Yeah.
So if it's only one man, he's going to be very well fed.
I suppose it is a step in the right direction, because if the whole certification and testing procedure in the construction products industry is as unfit for purpose as beginning to appear, then something needs to be done. You know, it remains to be seen how this regulator will actually make a difference.
I should say, in defence of the certification bodies that we've been slagging off, it's not just them. Occasionally they've given badges to people to say, you know, yep, that product is great for X. And the marketing teams of the product manufacturers themselves have forgotten the last bit of that sentence and just going out saying, yep, they say our product is great.
Yeah. Well, I think that actually indicates the main problem with all this. And I think this is why the current inquiry into the Grenfell fire is going to be extremely complicated, because it's not just, you cannot point the finger at just one person or one organisation. It seems to be a sort of a whole slew of failure across the entire industry. I mean, right from local authority building control through to manufacturing, design, testing, everything. Everybody's passing the buck. And as soon as you think you found the culprit, they can point to somebody else who is more culpable than them.
There's also the whole issue of using products in combination. It's perfectly okay that your milk is fresh and tasty and your garlic may be fabulous, but put them together and you won't have anything particularly good, I don't think.
Depends what you're cooking, of course.
I don't have any recipes with milk and garlic.
There's another building product story which you pointed out to me. I hadn't noticed a trend, actually. In the builder's merchant sector, There is an ongoing process of rationalisation, it appears. Tell us a bit about that, Phil.
Well, this week's specific story is that there is a builder's merchant in High Wycombe called Grant and Stone that has acquired CRS Building Supplies in Somerset. CRS has got 12 branches across Somerset, headquarters in Wells. And the coming together of these two organisations creates a builders merchant group with 44 branches between London and the South West, more than 500 employees and revenues of about £140 million. Good sized company. That in itself is not hugely significant, except that Grant & Stone was itself taken over only 14 months ago by a private equity outfit called Cairngorm Capital Partners. And that's a name that's been cropping up over and over and over again on the acquisitions trail in the building products world over the past 2 or 3 years. If you look at what Cairngorm Capital has bought in recent years, apart from Grant and Stone, they've put together something called the Independent Builders Merchant Group, including Parker Building Supplies, Stamco, Chandler's Building Supplies, National and North Yorkshire Timber, Cotswolds Manufacturing, a whole bunch of them
in
different bits. They haven't all bundled it together as one company. They've got sort of a doors business, a windows making and a joinery business, and then a builders merchant, or a couple of different builders merchant group, one under the Grant and Stone name and one under the Independent Builders Merchant Group network. And so, you know, Cairngorm are doing stuff here and really making a move. And they're not the only ones. At a much smaller level, it may be the beginning of it. I don't know where this is going to go. But last year, a young builders merchant outfit in Kidderminster sold an unspecified minority stake to venture capitalists to fund expansion. Now, that's a lot smaller, a lot earlier in the process than Cairngorm is, so we'll see what happens there. And then Hughes Gray, who bought Ridgeons a few years ago, keeps cropping up as someone who's buying companies.
Oh, yes.
They're not venture capital backed, they're management owned, but they've obviously got money behind them. They've bought Shropshire Building Supplies, James Wilby, Ridgeons, which now trades as Hughes Gray Ridgeons, and they bought Milford Building Supplies in Leeds last year as well. So Hughes Gray is another one that's been on the acquisition trail.
One of the things which I find interesting about this is I had no idea that there were so many small, independent, local builders merchants around the country. I mean, we've got one down here in North Devon, it extends way beyond North Devon, small, privately owned, small to medium-sized business. I mean, it's not a small business. It's got 20 branches, I think. I'm not going to name it, just in case they're a target for takeover. But, you know, it's a local builder's merchants, and it's no sort of cowboy outfit. It is a highly professional, and it is, in fact, the go-to builder's merchant supplier for small businesses, small building companies in the area. And the big boys like Travis Perkins and Dewson, which, if you remember last year, were closing branches around the country, weren't they, as a way of protecting themselves. They've got a very small penetration in this particular part of the world. Everybody goes to the local people. And it's interesting to see that this seems to be the case in other parts of the country as well. Everybody's got their local builders merchant, and they seem to inspire an awful lot of loyalty. So the fact that Cairngorm is, and others may be, busy buying them up, and often they're, because they're family businesses, people want to sell out and retire, sell up and retire rather, that they can amass this portfolio of thriving local builders merchants, and rather cannily not try and unify them under one particular banner, but keep them as local firms with their own unique local identity.
Well, half the value in these outfits is their brand name and their identity.
Yeah. So yes, it's an interesting development and an interesting trend, and it'll be worth keeping a finger on that particular pulse.
Well, I think there's a good reason why the builders merchant market is ripe for consolidation in a way that the sort of similar garden centres sector is not. You might think that how come no one's come along and consolidated the garden centres market? But garden centres is very much B2C rather than business consumer, rather than business to business like builders merchants. But whereas if you or I go into a garden centre, it tends to be a, we might be there with a specific purpose, but it tends to be recreational to a large extent. Whereas builders merchants, it may be necessary to visit the merchant to cast your eye over the slab of granite you want to buy or something. But on the whole, it's much more of a transactional relationship. I want bricks, give me bricks. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, that's moving online. And the big boys that you mentioned, the national players, have got these online platforms to make it very easy for customers to to put their orders in online and to track their orders and deliveries and all this sort of service that perhaps your mom and pop local builder's merchant simply hasn't got the infrastructure, the budget, isn't geared up, isn't ready to make that leap into the digital world. Mm. And maybe it takes a network of builders merchants to come together, to be created, to have the critical mass to afford the cost of moving into the digital world.
Although I think the way so your local jobbing builder will use a builder's merchant surely is that he'll phone up and say, I need a pallet of facing bricks for Wednesday morning. Can you have them ready for me? And he turns up in his pickup and somebody loads them onto the bed of the truck and he goes in and puts it on his account and off he goes. I think a lot of people tend to actually go to builders merchants in person and pick up materials on their way to the job, don't they?
Well, not if it's a bag of sand or something that needs the hi-ab to pick it out of the bag.
Yeah, that's true.
There is, of course, a different model for consolidation, which doesn't involve selling out or being taken over, but does help give you critical mass in the market. And that one is the Access Alliance, which is a network of, I don't know how many companies it is now, whether it's a dozen or whether it's two dozen, but an alliance of independent hire companies that hire out powered access, lifts and scissor lifts and so on. They've got their little regional pockets. There might be someone who's you know, quite busy or quite large in Cornwall or Devon and Cornwall, and someone else has got South Wales, mm-hmm. and someone else has got other, and they between them they can provide national coverage, and between them they can compete with the likes of Nationwide mm-hmm. or Loxam, as it is it now is, who have got proper national coverage. So by a regional alliance can say, well, together we're as big as that big national player.
Yeah.
Put us on your preferred supplier list or whatever. Come to us, and one of our gang will sort you out.
And yet, those companies are still independent, aren't they? They're not part of the same. They're not owned by the same organisation.
No. There's no. I mean, a couple of them might have shareholders common to both or something, but essentially they're all independent companies.
Right. Okay.
And it's more of a sort of a rehire model, I suppose. And I think when it started, and I'm guessing it would be 15 years ago, I may be 5 years out either way on that, I didn't necessarily see it having long-term legs, but it seems to have succeeded. I don't know how much business of any of those independent alliance members, how much of their turnover comes from the alliance and how much comes from their own local customer base. So I don't know the value of it, but it's still going, and it's survived, and the relationships have survived, which is another interesting model for perhaps local or regional players who perhaps haven't got the breadth mm-hmm. or scale to make the next step.
So how would it work if you were a small powered access hire company located in one part of the country? I mean, is the way it works that you are approached by somebody who wants to hire a piece of equipment outside your normal territory, and then you refer them to your partner in that territory that they went to hire in, and then you get a fee or a finder's fee as a result of that. Is that the way it works?
I don't know. I don't know the details of it. I don't know how the money works. But the first part of what you said is my understanding of it. That you know, you're there in Devon, and one of your customers rings up and says, "I need a boom lift, and I'm working in Kent next week. Can you send me a boom lift to Kent?"
Yeah.
Well, you don't want to send a truck to Kent and it's going to come back empty. So you'll ring up your mate. I don't know whether you ring up your mate in Kent or whether you give your customer your Kent mate's phone number.
Right, yes, I see, yeah.
But it's essentially pooling fleets to create a national fleet.
Yeah. So is that it then, Phil? Do you think we've covered everything this week?
Well, what have we talked about? Prompt payment, good news. Product regulation, good news. And builders merchant consolidation, good news if you're wanting to retire and sell your business. Yeah. There's some money men round the corner with bags of cash for you.
I think building products is probably the market to get into at the moment.
Well, it's steady and stable, isn't it?
I mean,
it's a bit like supermarkets. We're always going to need building products. Yep. And even if brick goes out of fashion and other, you know, air-created rises or whatever, there's always going to be a need for building materials and building products.
Yeah.
That is a given. So as an investor, it's a bit like investing in the water industry. It may not have huge returns, but it's got safe returns. It might have huge returns, but it's the solidity to it, which I think in the current economic climate has got a lot going for it. So I can understand why the building products as a market is interesting. And it's dynamic at the moment, of course, with all the regulations coming in.
It is.
Gives a bit of dynamism and change.
My brother-in-law was very pleased with himself. He phoned me up very excitedly to say that he had bought loads of shares in a brick manufacturer. And he urged me to do the same, as bricks are the future. I didn't say anything about off-site manufacturing because I didn't want to prick his bubble, but he might still be right. I mean, house building is still the sector of the industry which seems to be doing best at the moment, and I guess they'll always want bricks.
I think we've talked enough for this week, David.
I do too.
I need to go find out whether there are any more misbehaviour on the Capitol in Washington, because as we talk, the new president of the United States is about to be inaugurated.
Indeed.
I think he's the oldest one we've ever seen.
Yep.
He can't be any more batty than the last one. I'm sure he won't be.
Another one good for just one term, I should think. I mean, he's going to be 82, isn't he, by the time this term's over? Anyway, that's for the Americans to deal with. I think that's it for today, isn't it, Phil?
Yeah, let's call it a week. Everyone, thank you very much for listening to another dose of Reconstruction. As David mentioned at the outset, everything we've talked about, there's more there at theconstructionindex.co.uk. Do get in touch with us, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. Let us know what's aggravating you, what's agitating you, what's exciting you and enlivening you and inspiring you in your place of work. But from David and I, until next week, cheerio.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from The Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.